This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
Somebody asked me the other day if I organize my day or do I just go by vibes, and I was like,
"Who asked you this?"
I organize my day, obviously.
He organizes it by vibes.
Yeah, right.
In the morning, I try to ensure my vibes rise to a high enough degree that they can slowly waver for throughout the rest of the day, and by the night, I'm still vibing. You know.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice San Diego, and I'm joined by the managing editor, Andrea Lopez Villafano. What's up, Lopez?
What's up, Lewis? I really love that.
The. Yeah. And chief vibes reporter, Jacob McQuinney. What's up, Jacob?
I'm vibing.
Good. We got a lot of content to vibe through. Coming up on the show this week, the mailer wars are here. As we get closer to the special election to replace Nathan Fletcher on the Board of Supervisors in the county, the mailer game is heating up. Now, to me, mailers are like the core concentrate of local politics. You boil off politics and you're left with mailer content. We'll tell you what these latest ones mean and why they're interesting. Also, there was a big update to the lawsuit filed against Fletcher and the lawsuit that got him kicked out. We'll get into why it could be huge. And unfortunately, the cutbacks at the UT are coming to light. It is not pretty. Finally, we've talked about the ugly divorce between water agencies that's going through right now. It has progressed to a new level. The stakes are high, and the water fights are always the best fights. It's going to be a big show. Stay with us. Okay, there's a special election going on now. You're both in the district, right?
I'm not.
You're not?
I am.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no. So
I'm getting the mailers. I got my ballot. I'm going to,
It's
you know.
A ballot with just one question.
Yeah, what does it look like?
Well, it's it's an envelope that is unopened and will remain so until probably a day or two before it's due.
Oh, wow,
once I open it, I can let you know, though.
The election, of course, is to replace Nathan Fletcher on the District 4 seat of the County Board of Supervisors. There are five Board of Supervisors members, and he left the seat, and it's open. And there's a special election occurring to take that role. Now,
so did he just kind of, he was tired of being a supervisor? He
yeah,
just wanted
back
to
backpedal
like,
to the leaving the seat.
Yeah, he wanted to kind of maybe go try his hand at climbing Everest or something. Seems to be a...
He's done Denali, I think.
Has he really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. I was closer than I thought I was.
So, yes, Fletcher did leave that seat, and it was not in a positive light. There is more information this week about the accusations against him. So, let's just dial back. He is accused, of course, of sexual harassment, sexual assault against a former Metropolitan Transit System employee, a PIO. We've talked about her before, public information. We also have discussed, you know, the weird, awkward encounters they've had that were public, and then also her accusation that he both physically and emotionally sort of stalked her and pushed her into sexual encounters that she did not want. That's her accusation.
Both and, outside, over social media, and at the MTS building.
Yeah, in right outside the doors of the meetings that they were having. So he, we all knew this. This is not new. He obviously took it seriously enough that he left the seat. He checked into rehab for what he said was alcohol addiction and post-traumatic stress disorder. He has since returned, but we haven't heard anything from him. But the lawsuit against him continues on. And remember, our big question was not just about whether it was true or not what she alleged. And obviously, that's going to be hard to get an ultimate conclusive answer on. But the other question is how MTS handled it. Because MTS is a major agency with a vast public portfolio of services, in particular to get people around the county. And then also, it is a employer. It has a lot of money, a big budget, and a lot of employees. And so how it handles these things is important. And so the lawsuit against both Fletcher and MTS accuses them of firing Ms. Figueroa. This is Grecia Figueroa, who was a public information officer. They say that, or she says that she was fired on February 6th. So we all knew that, right? Mm-hmm. This week, the complaint that she filed was amended to add some more details. She says now in this amended complaint that the next day after she was fired, the human resources officer at MTS offered her $10,000 as a severance. And this is quoting now from the complaint. If Ms. Figueroa agreed to release all known and unknown claims about MTS and Fletcher, the offer also conditioned on Ms. Figueroa's agreement to never tell anyone about the settlement and to never, quote, make any statements or cause others to make statements that disparage the personal and or business reputations, practices, and or conduct of MTS.
So let me stop you there. Yes. In the morning report, you kind of explained why that's odd. It's not odd to get a severance after you're laid off from your job.
Or fired.
Or fired.
For cause, yeah. Mm-hmm. So two things stand out to me. One is the day. So she's fired on February 6th. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, they're giving her a severance. So if you're going to fire an employee, as MTS has said, for cause, generally in California, to avoid litigation about that, you really need to have like your ducks lined up. You have to have like your documents of like where this employee has come up short, how many opportunities they've had to correct that. And, you know, everything sort of needs to be clear so that when that moment happens, you guys can part as amicably as possible with, you know, some kind of, usually some kind of severance or some situation like that, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that would be odd to fire somebody and just say, get out, and not have the severance conversation immediately. Now, it happens, right? Sometimes something blows up and then you go and deal with it later or whatever. But in this case, they fired her abruptly, and she says there was no opportunity to speak with the supervisor, no warning, and she was required to leave immediately, which itself brings up all kinds of questions. So it's one thing if like this was a, you know, spaghetti factory or whatever, and she didn't show up for a shift, and they're like, get out.
Pack up your spaghetti, go.
Yeah. But this is MTS. This is a major government agency. It'd be weird for them to skip a lot of these steps.
Yeah.
And it's not like government agencies are known for like really culling like talent.
I mean, they have like an HR department.
Yeah, exactly. What's the point of that if not to follow a bunch of steps that government usually goes overboard following, right?
Yeah.
Especially in the case of like public employees. So that was the first odd thing. The second odd thing is big. If this is true, this would be actually huge to our understanding of what happened there. So this thing It says the offer was conditioned on Ms. Figueroa's agreement to never tell anyone about the settlement and to never make any statements or cause others to make statements and disparage personal or business reputations, practices, and conduct of MTS or Fletcher. Now, that's kind of standard or pretty normal language about non-disparagement or whatever that come in some of these agreements. That's not odd.
Up until the or Fletcher.
Right. So if she really was presented with don't say anything bad about MTS, and by the way, this guy Fletcher, now it'd be one thing to say officers of MTS or leaders or people at MTS or other employees at MTS, but to actually specify Fletcher, if that truly was in there, now it's not in quotes here, and the attorney didn't clarify for me whether the offer did include the mention specifically of Fletcher. But if the severance agreement that she was presented did include a reference specifically to him and him alone, that would indicate that MTS knew at that point, the day after at least, that they fired her, that she was going to bring a complaint about him specifically. Mm-hmm. And that would be interesting because all we know for certain about what MTS says it knew and when it knew it was that they were informed and found out about this about 11 days or 10 days later when she, Figueroa, and her lawyer sent their first claim, official claim, and sort of protect documents demand to MTS. Mm-hmm. Remember, that itself was a scandal because MTS later said, or had earlier said, that they didn't know anything about this until the lawsuit was filed, actually like several weeks later. Mm-hmm. And so when we found out it was actually they'd got this letter on the 17th of February, weeks earlier, that was a revelation. And now this thing says that you know they knew something was up with Fletcher the 7th. Now, it's very important to get that clarification. Did that severance agreement specifically mention Fletcher?
Mm-hmm. And it seems like, you know, from the beginning, you've been sort of, you and Andy have been sort of blowing the whistle on that this is much more than just about Fletcher. This could have massive fallout for an agency like MTS that's not only large, but serves this very important purpose. And in the sort of Nixonian chain of events of what did they know and when did they know it, what they knew and when they knew it seems to continue to be pushed back every single time we learn something new.
If this is true.
If this is true.
Yeah, there is evidence that as the complaint starts to become known at MTS that Fletcher and his own attorney try to deal with it directly. And so the question comes, did MTS allow this, the chairman of their organization, did the staff allow the chairman to try to handle this workplace allegation himself with his personal attorneys and try to get it swept under the rug or whatever or settled? Because if that's the case, then that's a real abrogation of their responsibilities to their mm-hmm. employees and a pretty significant oversight and one that should ensnare and you know actually cause pretty significant problems for the executive leadership at MTS, if mm-hmm. not demand that they be held accountable all the way to being terminated themselves, because mm-hmm. that's just bad. If your employee accuses like your chairman of this, like it needs to be handled as thoroughly and as well as you handle anything. Mm-hmm. And to just sort of punt it off, try to hand it off or otherwise quiet it by letting him handle it, that's bananas. And that's what this would imply, that they knew back then and they still let him try to handle it. And so... I don't have clarity about whether it specifically mentioned Fletcher. If it did, that's huge.
Yeah.
Jacob, I really appreciate you bringing in a lot of these mailers. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I know they were hard to part with. I know how.
Thank you for not throwing them away.
Yeah, I mean, sure, well, they're worth their weight in gold. And
he saw my drawer full of mailers, and mm-hmm. he was legit stoked for me. I was, yeah. Thank you.
He's Scott. For those who don't know, he's like a cat lady, but with political mailers.
You should know? Frame them or use them as a wallpaper for something.
But then he wouldn't be able to pull them down and look at both sides and talk about the sort of like
there was one
quantum game theory of these political mailers.
There was one from 5 years ago I was looking for, and I found it, and I was like, hey, I found it. And he showed the requisite enthusiasm.
Yeah. What is your filing system?
It's a pile.
Yeah, it is.
But it's basically chronological. Yeah, so you can estimate when 5 years ago.
As you were dropping them in, that's how they're going.
It would probably be really good for you to go in there and put some folders in, get a little bit of, I'm just telling you, I think it would help your mental health.
Yeah,
you know?
It's giving me a little bit of anxiety.
It is pretty anxiety inducing. Yeah.
I just want to organize
it. It's a Pandora's box of political mailers for
sure. I think it's fine. All right, so we are collecting them about this race. If you have some, let us know. So this is the race now to replace Nathan Fletcher on that board. We've talked about some things that are at stake there. Obviously, the county has immense influence on things like social welfare, on air pollution issues, on the parks and land use and such around the county. And there's going to be some big debates about that. Monica Montgomery Stepp, who's on the city council, is running for that seat. Janessa Goldbeck, who is a veteran and also leader of a veterans organization, advocacy organization, she's running. Those are the two Democrats. We have Amy Reichert, who's running. She became prominent with the Reopen San Diego campaign during the pandemic. And then
Paul McQuigg, he is also a veteran.
Okay. This is going to be really interesting to see how this goes. Now, there is a lot to learn from some of these mailers. So we talked about Janessa Goldbeck, for example, running and how she had a lot more sort of openness to building in the backcountry, which might be a huge issue for a lot of builders. And the builders endorsed her, at least the Building Industry Association did. And she had a note here that said, we need to add housing of all kinds, not just urban high-rises. Ooh.
Pass it down.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite spicy.
You know, Monica Montgomery Stepp has settled on it's time to step up for San Diego County.
I do love that.
You get that?
Yeah, that's I don't know. I'm not sold on that one. Okay, so Scott, I understand that you have come up with a system to categorize these mailers and what sort of strategies and tactics they use and what they signify. Can you expand on that?
Well, so remember, mailers, in my mind, if you think about it, all the polling, all the professional consultants, all of the campaign people that special interests and candidates hire to pull off their campaigns, they do a lot of research and they do a lot of polling and they come together with a lot of insights, and it's all there swimming around. And mailers are where it all gets like boiled down to its essence. The best things they think they can say to make you associate candidates with positive or negative images, right? And so I think you can learn a lot about what they think they know about us by studying these mailers. Now, there are two types of mailers where they're actually trying to play a little game that's not what it looks like on the mailer. So the first type I call the bank shot, right? So the bank shot is where a special interest or a party is trying to support a candidate by actually promoting and supporting another candidate.
What does that mean? Can you expand on that?
Well, so for instance, thank you for asking.
Yeah.
The Laborers International Union of North America, 89, LIUNA as it's known, they do not support Amy Reichert, the Republican, running in this seat. That's very clear. They don't want her to be the county supervisor. They have endorsed Monica Montgomery Stepp. And they, though, have spent now a lot of money and are supporting and sending out mailers for Amy Reichert.
What?
They actually sent a mailer, said, let's take our county back, vote Amy Reichert for county supervisor. And then you flip it over, and it's got this little bio about how great she is and all the groups that have supported her. And at the disclosure part, it says paid for by the laborers.
Okay, so why would an organization that clearly doesn't want the candidate to win spend money supporting that candidate.
So they want her to make it to the runoff. They would prefer that Monica Montgomery Stepp face this candidate, Amy Reichert, in the runoff. The district is heavily Democratic. They think they can easily attack this candidate, the Republican, and they can save themselves a lot of money and heartache not having to spend a bunch of money against the other Democrat in the race, Janessa Goldbeck. Because if it's a runoff and it's Monica Montgomery Stepp versus Janessa Goldbeck, a lot of people are going to have to make uncomfortable decisions about which one to support. And then they'll have to spend a ton of money on that. And then they might lose. And the person who wins might not be so pleased that that's the way it happened. Right?
So Leuna sees this Republican against Democrat matchup as easier to win than Democrat versus Democrat, both cheaper and more clear for voters in a district that is majority Democrat.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's the bank shot. Do you want to hear about the double bank shot?
I am curious, but so bank shot makes sense, right? That's a basketball term.
Uh-huh.
Double bank shot, what would that be in basketball? Is that like an alley-oop off the backboard?
It would be like if you were super strong and you hit like a bank shot off one and it bounced off the other one and landed in.
Okay. So it's like an own goal almost. Not really, I guess, no. Right? You'd be hitting it off your own backboard and then it flies all
Can
the way
you
across
stop?
The court.
Isn't it more like, you know that game that you play with the puck thing? It's like air hockey and yeah. Sometimes it hits the side and it accidentally goes into
your thing?
Okay,
that's a better.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, or like pool. Yeah, you got to like hit the one side and come back.
Okay, this is making more sense now.
But that's, you need two. I'm talking about two.
Okay.
You need two ricochets.
Yeah. Okay, so the other day you dug through your chest of treasures and pulled out this shining example of the double bank shot.
It's very rare. Okay. When you see a double bank shot in the wild, like you need to give it to me.
It's like the triple rainbow of.
It's like a rare bird that you need to take a picture of. Okay. So it's actually pertinent to this race. Nathan Fletcher won election to this seat in 2018, and he was running against the former district attorney, Bonnie Dumanis, a conservative Republican, and there were conservative interests that supported her, right? So they sent out a mailer at that time. If you look at it, it says, Nathan Fletcher, protecting our right to bear arms, with a smiling picture of Nathan Fletcher. And he says, Nathan Fletcher has a proven record of standing up to gun-grabbing liberals like Lori Saldana. A rating from the NRA and all this stuff. Okay, so it looks like it's promoting Nathan Fletcher, right? Mm-hmm. And then on the back, it has all this negative stuff about Lori Saldana. She's a gun control activist. F rating from the National Rifle Association. All these signs above or up below her of people holding up saying, no guns. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this looks like a pro-Nathan Fletcher piece and an anti-Lori Saldana piece. But when you look at who they sent this to, it was actually sent to people who they have made the determination would actually not like somebody who is pro-guns or pro-access to firearms, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, would actually sympathize more with Lori Saldana. And so this is what I mean by a double bank shot. They are sending out something that looks like it's promoting one candidate, but it's actually meant to, and it's opposed to another candidate, but it's meant to promote the candidate it looks like it's opposed to support a third candidate.
Wow.
Because they wanted Lori Saldana to advance to the runoff because they thought that Lori Saldana would be easier to beat in the runoff if it actually got there.
Wow. This is real galaxy brain stuff. So I have a question. Did that mailer work? I mean, obviously, I know the answer because Lori Saldana is not in office right now.
Lori Saldana did not make the runoff. Nathan Fletcher made the runoff and he won it.
Got it.
Rather handily, too. But if you were to take anything in my office, like come in and steal something, and you took this would hurt me more than like my like softball trophy or whatever.
I mean, there's like a picture of your family in there. You really want to stick to that?
Well, yeah, but I got more of those.
Okay. You got the negatives of the picture of your family.
This is gold.
This is the rare. Now, it's I think it's a little, I haven't seen one yet work. I've seen maybe two or three of these. Mm. And it just feels like it's a little too clever.
Yeah.
Like it's just trying a little bit too hard. But they keep trying new ways to do this. Like promote somebody that they think is actually going to turn the people off and make them act this way versus that way. Now, the most successful version of the basic bank shot that I've seen is the effort last year to oppose, again, Lori Saldana was running for city council in the coastal district that Jen Campbell had. Mm-hmm. And people who supported Jen Campbell knew that Lori Saldana making the runoff would be very hard to oppose, that they would have a very hard time beating her in the runoff. So they supported the Republican in the race to make the runoff, and then they beat the Republican in the runoff. Mm. And so...
So this is like the successful version of what Hillary Clinton's people tried to do.
Yeah, the bank shot has a pretty high success rate.
Uh-huh.
The double bank shot is still an experiment. Okay, one of the bigger other questions we were waiting for in this race was to see if public safety unions in particular decided to spend, and it looks like they have. So another group of mailers is going out. This one is attacking Monica Montgomery Stepp, and it is from the Police Officers Association. It says, Monica Montgomery Stepp is a threat to public safety, skyrocketing homicides, supports defunding our police. All those things. So that is interesting for a couple reasons, because one is the Police Officers Association is the city of San Diego's union, not the county of San Diego's sheriff's union. They actually have no role in the county. So they're just trying to hurt her. That's all. And that would show how tense their relationship has ended up over years. She obviously took the lead on criminal justice reform, on oversight of police and police accountability issues, and they don't like that. And then that would also indicate the Police Officers Association is not going to do that unless the Deputy Sheriff's Association wants to do that a lot. And so that would indicate the sheriffs are probably coming in strong. Now, that would also mean that the sheriffs might be the place where some of this money opposed to Montgomery Stepp goes, including the builders and others might contribute to that. So I would bet you'd see the builders and a few others come in hard against Monica Montgomery Stepp and for Janessa.
Wow.
Watch out for those mailers.
Okay, I will.
If you have any mailers from this race or others, I'm always interested in them. You can send them to scott@voiceofsandiego.org. scott@voiceofsandiego.org. Well, we are all still trying to digest the news about the Union Tribune and its new ownership and the cuts that they are trying to realize. And we are finally seeing the impact of that transition and those cuts. And it is pretty bleak because, remember, these are buyouts. These are the voluntary round. And if they're willing to accept some of the people applying for the buyout that have applied and announced that they're leaving, that would indicate to me that they are being very liberal about the number of people that they're willing to accept buyouts from, and thus also the people that they might want to lay off after this. So let's get into this for a second. So I think the biggest name, of course, at this point is the editor and publisher, Jeff Light. He had gotten the job back in 2010 as editor of the paper under the last private equity firm that had taken over the paper. He survived the ownership of Doug Manchester. He had survived the ownership of the Tribune Company and Tronc. And he survived the leadership of Patrick Soon-Shin, the richest man in LA. And now Patrick Soon-Shin has sold the paper to Media News Group, owned by Alden Global Capital. And now Jeff Light's out.
Yeah, Jeff sent an email to Union Tribune employees, and yeah, he said 13 years at the company, and this is his last week.
So what do you think this signals, that the top guy, as you said, who's been around and leading this organization for over a decade, what does it signal that he is now gone as well?
Well, we talked, I think, about this, and I've written about this, that Jeff Light was on a really big endeavor. He was something of a historic endeavor, basically, to transition the paper to an online future. That, remember, as I said, they're all marching towards a cliff, and that's the moment when the money they bring in from all of the different sources of revenue no longer justifies printing the actual newspaper. And he saw all of that very clearly and was working really hard and talking a lot about building up enough digital subscriptions and digital ad revenue to make it so that they could support the news system and the newsroom that they had into the future. And he felt pretty confident that they were going to make that. And so I talked about how losing Patrick Soon-Shin as the sort of financial lead of that effort, the steward of that effort, felt like something of an abandonment, like right in the middle, right at the moment when that transition needs to occur to leave, felt like a betrayal. But then for him to leave means that that endeavor at least is not going to go the way that he thought it was, or that he's not going to be in charge of it. And yeah, I think that's huge. I mean, he's a big deal. Well, you know, so how do you feel like he was as an editor there?
I mean, he was a great leader. I think he always had a willingness to listen to everybody. And I mean, my experiences with him were always great. And he just had this way of presenting his vision for the paper and journalism that was really inspiring, I would say. And yeah, I think this is a big loss. And you have a lot of really talented individuals who are also leaving. And yeah, so many of them I worked with all the time. So it's pretty sad.
Yeah, so the initial list we saw, our former alum, Sam Hodgson, who had gotten to be director of photography there, he took the buyout. These are all public. There's a bunch that haven't acknowledged or talked about what they're doing yet. So that's what also sort of drives home just how big this is. Just the public names themselves would be a huge loss. Greg Moran, investigative and courts reporter. Kate Morrissey, she was a very impactful border and sort of immigration cover coverage a journalist. There was Deborah Brennan, Dana Littlefield, you know, as an editor there.
Public safety editor.
A longtime columnist, Diane Bell. We saw, again, the list is just brutal. And that's just what we've seen from the actual volunteers. We'll see how many people end up taking the buyout. And then, of course, whether there's involuntary reductions that happen after that. Oh, I'm forgetting Joshua Emerson Smith, environment reporter.
Gary Worth
has been covering homelessness. Now, he had an amazing quote, I think, in the piece about this that the NBC San Diego did. And I think this was really drove home just how much has changed in newspapering. So he said, quote, "I used to cover a school district, and then I covered a region of school districts. And then I covered half the school districts in North County. And then I covered all the school districts in North County. And then I covered all the school districts in San Diego County, plus the colleges." And that was before he covered homelessness. Like, that just shows, like, one reporter used to cover more specific and narrow topics. And then as the cuts come, they just have to take over broader, broader areas. We always, and one thing I always think is, like, we always looked at the UT as the skeleton of coverage in San Diego, that they were the bones. They covered things that needed to be covered, and we could be like muscle on top. We could look at things. We had that freedom. We didn't need to hold the whole structure up. We just needed to do important work on top of it. And that's what's scary about these cuts. This is like core bones getting cut. You know, the border reporter, the homelessness reporter, the courts County reporter. The courts are covered so poorly right now. I mean, not a reflection on them. I'm just saying, like, there's just not enough people in courts watching what's happening. And so, yeah, it's a big deal. Now, I think it's about time for the new owners to say something.
Yeah, it's super, super quiet. I mean, maybe they're internally, but I think we would know already because we're all journalists.
Yeah, they're giving us everything. I think internally is one thing. Like, they have their own employees to deal with, and I know from experience, but much smaller scale, like, you got to be present in the in those days after. I understand how difficult that is. But the other issue is the paper has been a big deal in San Diego for a long time, whether we liked it or didn't like it. What is the vision for its place now in the future? What are you going to try to cover? Where are you going to leave things out? What's your vision for the editorial department, for the perspectives, the endorsements? Other papers that they have don't endorse candidates. They took that responsibility away from the editorial team. So does that mean that team is gone? What are we doing? That's all we'd like.
Yeah. And I think it's important, like you said, just this small partial list that NBC published. I mean, this is hundreds of years of experience with newspapers, with San Diego Union Tribune. That is a huge loss. And there needs to be some sort of public presence to sort of steady the ship. And I don't know that I certainly haven't seen that. And I feel so badly, not only for San Diego, but for everybody who's having to make this difficult decision.
So when you look at the face of certain organizations, we often talk about that, right? Like mm-hmm. Who's the face? Who's the one most prominent? So Jeff Light, obviously, but he didn't have like a very prominent necessarily face all the time. He would make speeches, he would do interviews and stuff like that. He'd have public events. But then that brings up the question of like, well, okay, who's the next face? It used to be the Bob Kittle, the head of the editorial department at the UT, was a big face in San Diego. He's always on the roundtables and always saying controversial things and had a perspective. And people always, a lot of public affairs people always cared about what he was going to do. Mm. And then Matt Hall sort of took that role. And Matt Hall's been posting cryptic things about whether he's going to be around or not, too. Like, so it's who's going to be the face? Who's going to be the voices? If Diane Bell's gone, who else are we not going to see that sort of represent what we know about that institution that's been around for so long? And can I make a final point, too? There's a lot of conservatives like dancing. Not a lot. There's a few conservatives sort of dancing on the grave, like, haha, good, you know, learn to code or figure, you know, yeah. Just all this like snide stuff about this. I don't know any worldview that sees, you know, Greg Moran and Gary Warth and Diane Bell, Dana Littlefield leaving that makes things better for conservatives. They, you know, is it just like public safety news and other things that just not having that is better? Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense. So nobody should be pleased about this. Even if you have a bone to pick with the UT, this isn't going to make the paper better. And they're definitely not going to replace the people listed here with like somebody more ideologically bound. They are not going to spend the money to do anything like that. Mm. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
You know, I have to admit, this Max coverage of this water divorce has been super interesting, but it's really, honestly, it's really hard to take it seriously for me. I hear LAFCO, and it just sounds like the Acme version of a public agency, like this this satire of what a public agency is.
Yeah, like they didn't try hard enough to come up with an actual agency. They just it's LAFCO.
LAFCO.
Yeah.
Okay, but for the uninitiated, which is partly me, because I get like halfway through these stories and I just start laughing and imagine like Wile E. Coyote with riding a rocket that says LAFCO. So what is this divorce? Why does it matter? Why should people care about what's going on up in North County here?
Well, we talked about it right before Andy Keats left as a co-host here.
R.I.P.
And he was joking about how like he was leaving the seat the moment that LAFCO
finally heating up
became a big deal. And it did. LAFCO ended up pulling some gangster moves to get itself some serious relevance in this moment. So I think it's important to sort of break down exactly what happened, just because there was a lot at stake, and they pulled a big power play for sure. So LAFCO is the Local Agency Formation Commission. Its job is to sort of decide where lines are drawn, right? If a city wants to annex part of the other cities, or if a water district wants to change its boundaries, that sort of thing, it goes through LAFCO. Now, it's always flown under the radar, except for this is such a big deal. So just a broad overview, and then we'll get to what's at stake and why it's such a big deal. So the County Water Authority is made up of all these water districts. The city of San Diego is the biggest, but there's a bunch of others. Otay, all these places that provide water to their literal ratepayers, to their people and the businesses within their boundaries. And they all contribute to the Water Authority, and the Water Authority buys water from various sources, or desalination plants, or from the Metropolitan Water District. Now, Metropolitan Water District is this giant agency of which the San Diego County Water Authority is one member of. I think they have like 16% of the vote or something like that. So they are one big member of a much larger agency, just a gigantic Southern California Water Agency. This thing is just a massive, billions and billions of dollars that they handle to deliver water to what is essentially like 17 million people in Southern California, right? So the County Water Authority for the last 30 years has been fighting MET. That's what MWD is called, the Metropolitan Water District. They call it MET or MET. And they have been fighting because MET, 30 years ago, there was a big drought, and MET threatened to have to execute sort of serious cutbacks in water availability to San Diego. And San Diego made a determination at that point that we're never going to be as vulnerable as we were then. Mm. We're going to try to make sure we get water from other sources, things like desalination. We're going to have better reservoirs, and we're going to get our access to our own water sources. And that's when they made the deal to purchase water from the Imperial County, and farmers fallowed their lands.
Mm.
There's a word.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the water is now technically San Diego's. Now, what's funny about water politics is that, like, actually, it's still the same water. It's just that we have a claim to it. So Metropolitan Water District still delivers the water that we got from the Imperial County. It's just that it's our water. It's not theirs. Does that make sense?
Okay.
You're right. There's like a whole thing of water.
It's the same.
This little thing flowing over here is ours.
Yeah.
So is this what the James Cameron movie was about?
Which James Cameron movie?
The Way of Water.
Oh, yeah.
Water. Avatar.
I like what you did there. Yes. So I think that this is important to understand when we get to this discussion. Now, the reason why that's so important is that all of those moves, in particular desalination, the purchase of the water from Imperial County, and all of this infrastructure that they've built in the meantime has cost a lot of money. They borrowed a ton of money to do that, and they're paying that money off over time. Those payments have to be paid, right? And people during that time also stopped using as much water because we were told not to use as much water, which means they paid less for water, which means that all of that contributed to them needing to charge more for water. Even though we used less water or about the same, even with all the growth, we still had to pay higher rates. And so rates have been going up significantly. At the same time, there's these avocado growers and other people in Fallbrook and in Rainbow who don't want to pay higher rates. They would rather pay lower rates because I don't know if you've noticed, but avocado trees take a lot of water.
Mm.
You have to water an avocado tree all the time. Yeah. It just is a giant water suck.
Yeah, but I mean also, like, if you go to the store and there are two bottles of the same exact water and one is cheaper and one is expensive, I don't think you have to be growing avocados to be more attracted to the one that's cheaper, right?
So for years, they've been agitating about this because one of the interesting parts of this is that Rainbow and Fallbrook have a direct connection to the Metropolitan Water District. They don't even get their water through that same system that San Diego County Water Authority delivers everything through to the rest of San Diego County. They get it already direct from Metropolitan through the Eastern Water District, which is like Riverside County and stuff. And so they basically said, like, hey, we can pay a lot less if we join directly this Eastern group, and we would like to do that. Now, the Water Authority is like, no, you can't. You and everybody else are part of this system. We bought all these things together, and we're going to need to pay them off, and you need to help us do that. And so they've basically brought up three reasons why these guys can't leave. One is, if you leave, the rest of our ratepayers are going to have to pay more, and that's not fair to them. The second is, if you leave, we will lose some voting power on the Metropolitan Water District. And we've just barely gotten enough leverage to get things done and get more supportive leadership at the Metropolitan Water District. And so even if it's like 0.5% of vote, weighted vote value, that's going to matter a lot. And you can't, you shouldn't take that away from us. You can't take that away from us. And then the third is, they're kind of worried about, there's something I can't quite get my hands on or get people to fully articulate, but it's something about like the prestige of the San Diego County Water Authority is in jeopardy. It's like a, you know, a chink in their armor. Oh, they're just like,
it's like a vibe thing.
Is it like if some leave, then others might choose to leave?
Right. That it's like this like collective spirit is going to start to falter. Now, other districts don't have that same direct connection to the Metropolitan Water District, so they, leaving would be a much more difficult thing to pull off. But yeah, there's a vibes thing. Yeah. Absolutely.
So Rainbow and Fallbrook are basically saying, we want to cut out the middleman. We want to get this water directly from another dealer where it will be cheaper.
Yeah, they point out that they don't benefit from the same sort of reliability benefits that the other people get. If there is a big cutback, then they won't have as much backup just because of the remoteness of their region. They also say, look, we oppose desalination. You guys decided to do that. Just background on that real quick. So we built this desalination plant, and the idea was that the water was so expensive from desalination, but eventually it would be less expensive than the water that was imported through the Metropolitan Water District, and that line would cross sometime in the next decade. Now, it hasn't gone by projections, and so they're like, look, you were wrong about that, and we opposed you building that. It's too expensive. We just want this cheaper water. Please let us go. We'll give you $5 million a year.
I have a random question. Yeah. You might not have an answer to. I don't know. If they join Riverside, how much of a voting power does Riverside have compared to San Diego? And does Rainbow and Fallbrook group itself with a group that has less voting power?
Yes, but it's like 0.5%. It doesn't really change that much for Eastern or the other groups. But again, San Diego County has used just that little percentage to get some things done. Like, they actually decided who was going to be the chair and who was going to be the leader of Metropolitan Water District because they had just enough that combined with some of their friends, they were able to pull something off. And so that's kind of a bigger deal. Now, this has gone all the way up to Sacramento now because the city of San Diego put forward a bill that says if you want to leave, you have to get a vote of the entire county. Right now, under LAFCO's rules, the only people who have to vote are the residents and ratepayers in Rainbow and Fallbrook. They want to put forward this legislation that says, no, if a water district wants to leave, they have to get the entire county to vote on that. And that would be a big deal. And so now this has gone all the way to the top. So the chamber has sent people to speak about this. The unions have sent people to speak about this. They want the Water Authority to stay whole. They love all this investment that they're making and love all the jobs it's creating, right? The Big Avocado, though, on the other side, has gotten involved. There's a lobbyist an avocado lobbyist named Louie, who showed up.
Louie the lobbyist. Yeah. That's his name, cute. Huh?
And he's involved now, like advocating for Fall, Brook, and Rainbow. This has turned into like a huge...
Advocating?
Yeah. God damn it. Wow. Andy would quit. Andy would put his headphones down and walk out right now. Yes, so the big avocating has occurred. So yeah, so this is now interesting because as our Mackenzie Elmer, who's followed this really well, discovered this week, that this is now on an urgent track for legislation. And so the idea being that if you get 2/3 of both parts of the California legislature to support this, it can be applied urgently, and they say retroactively to this vote. Now, the other guys say, like, no, you can't, it's done, like, there's no retroactive thing involved. But they think it can, and they think they can get this urgent thing through. Now, that would work if all the Democrats are aboard, but what Mackenzie discovered is that one Democrat actually decided he doesn't support it, and that would indicate that more might not support it, which means that it might not get done at all, which would be yet another failure for the Water Authority on this decision. Now, lastly, this LAFCO vote. So they needed 5 votes to get this separation approved at LAFCO, right? But there was one lady, Jo Mackenzie, who was on that LAFCO board, who seemed like she was opposed to this vote. But she had let them know that in July that she wouldn't be available to vote on it. They made an emergency decision to schedule the vote during the July vote so that, but she wasn't able to attend that. Her alternate was there, and he supported the decision to separate. Wow. So that was the 5 votes that they needed to
into Game of Thrones. Huh?
Yeah. Gangsta.
So LAFCO is essentially... There was the big La Jolla news. They were trying to separate from that. That's who would decide if LAFCO would.
Right. LAFCO would decide. And LAFCO would decide, how much it cost. Because in that situation, La Jolla and City of San Diego share just a ton of like actual infrastructure. Mm-hmm. In this situation, Rainbow and Fallbrook have their own thing. And so it's not as dramatic of a divorce. But in that one, both La Jolla and the City of San Diego would have to vote. That's the difference between the laws regarding some of the cities and the laws regarding the water districts. And so what Rainbow says is, look, if you said that the whole county have to vote if we leave the Water Authority, we would have never joined the Water Authority from the beginning. So,
wow, changing the rules halfway through the game, huh?
Yeah, so exactly.
Huh.
All right, you can follow this and all the stories that matter in that world at vosd.org/environment. That's the environment report that our Mackenzie Elmer puts out and does so well. Thanks for listening to the Voice San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in this part of San Diego. These are uncertain times for local news. We need your support. To ensure institutions like ours are stable and sustainable, we need donors and subscribers. If you've never donated or think you can increase your contribution, you can do that now at vosd.org/give. That's vosd.org/give. And you can support us by subscribing to our newsletters. We have a great collection of newsletters featuring the voices of our journalists. See them all at vosd.org/newsletters. The links of what we've referred to are in the show notes as well. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrea Lopez-Villafana is our Managing Editor. Jacob McQuinney is our Education Reporter. And Nate Johns, our excellent producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.